Hey everyone, I'm Kelsey Snow, and this is Sorry I'm Sad, a podcast about grief, loss, and the importance of hope. When I was 35 years old, my husband, Chris, was diagnosed with aggressive progressing ALS and given 6 to 12 months to live. He was 37 at the time. Our kids were 7 and 4. We knew the lifespan the doctor gave him was accurate because Chris's dad had died of ALS not even a year earlier, 9 months after his diagnosis. We'd also lost two of his uncles, both within 9 months of diagnosis, and his 28-year-old cousin, 18 months after diagnosis. Most ALS is sporadic, meaning there is no family history, but 10 to 15% is passed down from one generation to another, and that is the kind that has decimated our family. Luckily, thanks to science and access to a very promising clinical trial, Chris is still here and very much living his life, almost 2 years after he was diagnosed. I'm a former journalist. I covered Major League Baseball for 5 years for the St. Paul Pioneer Press in Minnesota, and I've also written for the Boston Globe, the Los Angeles Times, and Sports Illustrated. Almost immediately after Chris was diagnosed, I realized that writing was how I would process all of these very big emotions that I was going through. After we went public with Chris's diagnosis, I started telling our story on my blog, which you can find at www.kelseysnowwrites.com. That's KelseySnowWrites.com. The more I wrote about my own sadness and grief, the more messages I got from people telling me their stories, saying things like, "You are describing my grief. Your words are what I feel but haven't been able to say." And the more messages I got, the more convinced I became that we need more spaces to share our stories of sadness and of resilience. Sharing the constant push and pull of my grief feels right to me. But sharing the saddest, most deeply personal parts of ourselves isn't for everybody. Even still, I believe that if you don't want to share your story out loud with the world, you do want to hear other people's stories. You want to feel that sense of community. You want to know that you aren't out there in this alone. And that's what I really hope this podcast is, a space where we can talk about our grief honestly, where we can share with the world these raw parts of ourselves and see what happens when we do that. Because in my experience, what happens when I do that is I feel lighter. I feel stronger. I feel like I can keep going. And that's how I hope you feel after listening. Because really, we're all just out here in this huge, messy, grief-riddled world together, limping along, offering a hand, reminding each other that there's so much beauty left to see, so much love left to feel, and so many connections left to make. This podcast and my blog are each a labor of love. And I mean that literally. From finding guests and researching topics to preparing interviews and recording and editing all the audio myself to writing blog posts and editing them, a great deal of my time and energy and love goes into each episode and each post. So if you value my work and you'd like to support it, you can go to www.patreon.com/KelseySnow and become a member. What seems to her like a lifetime ago, Melanie Masterson was a healthy, fit mom of three little girls. She ran behind her double stroller, did yoga, ate a plant-based diet, and at 39 years old, she was getting ready to rekindle her work as a freelance writer. She found herself feeling increasingly exhausted, but with a 7, 5, and 2-year-old, who wouldn't be? And then she started coming down with really terrible colds, with coughs so bad she was breaking ribs. Eventually, she was breaking ribs without any coughing at all. By the time she sat in a doctor's office to hear a diagnosis that would change the trajectory of her life, she had 7 broken ribs. The cause? Metastatic breast cancer that had spread so thoroughly into her bones that her oncologist didn't think Melanie would live for a year. That was 5.5 years ago. Melanie has been living with terminal cancer ever since. She's a mom in my neighborhood. Her girls are now 12, 10, and 8. Our kids go to the same school. Before I started this podcast, before my own life was changed when my husband was diagnosed with a terminal illness, I saw Melanie on the playground, sat with her at a playdate or two, chaperoned a field trip with her. I remember talking to her, walking away and thinking, I can't imagine what she's going through. Now, of course, I can. As author Susan Sontag, who suffered through three types of cancer, the last of which led to her death at 71 years old, wrote, "Everyone who is born holds dual citizenship in the kingdom of the well and in the kingdom of the sick. Although we all prefer to use the good passport, sooner or later, each of us is obliged, at least for a spell, to identify ourselves as citizens of that other place." Since her initial diagnosis, Melanie has gone through multiple rounds of chemotherapy and various bouts of radiation. She's lost her hair twice. She had a double mastectomy that left her without the recurring tumors in her breasts, but with tight, painful scarring across her chest. She still breaks ribs, sometimes even while sleeping. She has tumors in her uterus, and last year she had her right hip replaced and cement injected in her spine in attempts to stabilize it. When we talked last week over Zoom, it was clear the cement wasn't working any longer. As she sat in front of her phone with red lipstick on and her short, curly hair beautifully styled, she had 4 compression fractures in her vertebrae. This is a conversation about how to keep going when you take up permanent residence in the kingdom of the sick. It's about finding joy and peace despite living with both debilitating pain and debilitating sadness. It's about what illness takes from us, what makes life worth living, and what we want to leave behind for our people when we die. Like all conversations in this space, this one is very honest. Because of COVID and her health, Melanie is still in the throes of perhaps her most difficult year yet. And you will hear us talk very frankly about how long-term illness impacts all areas of your life. The one part that I hesitated to keep in the conversation was when we talked about how her cancer has impacted her marriage. It's deeply personal and deeply painful. But Melanie has long written honestly about her illness on her blog, and she wanted me to keep this part in. What you will hear is heartbreaking, but it is real. And for people dealing with a drawn-out illness, this is something that is often unspoken, but is certainly not uncommon. A few days after I recorded this conversation, Melanie posted a photo to Instagram of her cutting her husband's hair. Next to it, she wrote, "Somewhere under the depression and cancer anxiety is my best friend. I just need to find that person again. This is why marriage is so freaking hard, and putting cancer and COVID on top of it just isn't fair." It is so freaking hard, and it certainly isn't fair at all. This is Melanie's story. So despite the fact that our children go to the same school and we live 5 blocks away from each other, I can't remember the last time I actually saw you, thanks to COVID and all this.
Yeah, it's been pretty isolating, I have to say.
It is. And, you know, I was thinking about that in relation to being sick and how it's almost given people a little glimpse into the life of a sick person, this like sort of isolation, disconnection, monotony. And I wonder if you've had anybody say that to you, like, "Hey, I realize this is kind of maybe what you go through, have been going through off and on all these years. And sorry, I didn't really get it till now."
I haven't actually. But it is true. Like before, I actually had an operation on March 13th of last year, which is when everything basically shut down. So I was in the hospital getting a new hip, of all things. And thankfully I got in time. But the 6 months before that, I was basically already in isolation because of my hip. I go through periods where I can't drive. And it's not, nobody tells me not to drive. It's a safety thing, right? Like I know my reaction time with a bad hip is going to be, or with my, right now with my ribs and my spine issue, it's just not safe. I felt like I had already been in isolation for 6 months and then this COVID came up and it was just more of the same.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. Recently you wrote, so you're a writer and you've been writing, we just talked about before we started recording that you went to journalism school, you and I both have that in common. And how long have you been blogging? How many years do you think you've had a blog?
I've been blogging since 2000.
Wow. Yeah. So you've been blogging for a long time. I wanted to read something that you wrote, recently, kind of looking back on the last year.
And you wrote, those weeks post-surgery, you're talking about your hip replacement, were full of pain. The pain medication that I had been on since the previous summer had stopped working, but the doctor kept increasing my dosage, which made me feel drugged up and in pain. I remember being taken out for a drive during that time and thinking that I was so trapped in this body where everything hurt all the time and I had no way to escape, no way to even escape the house to have a couple moments to myself as I was trying to heal. And in the midst of all this, having to spend my days trying to navigate online homeschooling 3 different grades and try to act like everything is fine. That resulted in another panic attack where I lay in bed all afternoon, sobbing alone in my room. Sometimes I would wake up in the middle of the night sobbing loudly and scaring the children because I would have a panic attack in my sleep. And while I am definitely the kind of person who tries to find the good in everything and keep a positive attitude, I think I can say that this last year was one of the worst in my entire life. Between being in constant pain, having to reassure my daughters constantly that this pandemic will end, and the worry that my marriage is not going to survive both the pandemic and me having cancer, it has been an absolute shit year. Never before have I felt so alone and unheard and unwanted. That is a lot of heavy stuff.
Yeah.
I wondered what you could tell me about, like, specifically that being sick during the pandemic, because while everybody else was going through something similar, it was, like you already mentioned, just compounded for you.
Yeah. It was, I remember that day like so clearly, just because I just started crying in the car, and just even like any little bumps in the car, you know, just hurt, and they kept increasing. I was on opioids. I'm still on a form of opioid, but much different for pain management, and it was making me loopy, and it wasn't covering the pain. It's weird because, you know, it'd make you just like shut your body down, but like my brain would be going and going. Mm-hmm. I'd be like, I just want to sleep, but it wouldn't let me sleep. So I would just be laying there thinking and thinking and thinking. And with a new hip, you know, I could barely move. And when I first got it, I thought, I'm never doing this again. But of course I will if I have to, because mm-hmm. I can walk now.
Yeah.
So it makes a huge difference, but the, you know, the 4 weeks following, but it has been like, it's been one hell of a year. Like, I don't know how else to describe it. And to pretend that it hasn't been is doing myself a disservice. You know, the girls, they're mostly doing okay. But even this morning, like, they were so anxious to go back to school, being pulled out and having to go back and then being pulled out and having to go back. It's just, it's really hard on them.
Mm-hmm. When you have those moments, like in the car or in the house, where you kind of have a day where you're just, you know, on the bed crying, I think that one of the hardest things for me in Chris's diagnosis has been figuring out how much of my emotion to expose my kids to. And there are times when you just cannot help it. Like, there's no choice, right? They're going to see you lose it. And I wonder, you know, in those situations, how your kids interact with your sadness.
I think because I've been living with this for 5 years now, like, mm-hmm. it's, 2 of them don't know what it's like not to have a sick mom.
Right.
Like, when Una was 2 when I was diagnosed, and my mom came out to help, and she told my mom to go back to the side of the universe she came from. Like, I know, at 2 years old, because she was my baby and she had all of my attention all of the time. I couldn't pick her up anymore, which really upset her. Mm. Like, she kept asking, when are you going to pick me up? When are you going to be able to pick me up again? But I had so many broken bones just from the cancer that I could barely walk. And so that makes me really sad that I'm not the mom I expected to be. I'm going to end up crying.
It's okay too. Oh man. No, there's so many things that you have to grieve in these things. And that's absolutely so high up there, is this loss of what you thought life would look like for you, but for your kids.
Yeah. Like, you know, a super fit mom before, running with a double stroller up hills, probably with cancer. Like, I suspect I've had cancer since before my youngest was conceived, looking back on things and like health wise. And because I was so healthy, it was hidden, mm-hmm. you know? So nobody expects, you know, and you're tired all the time because you're nursing 24 yeah. hours a day mm-hmm. for like 6 years. And so you just expect you're tired because of the babies. Mm-hmm. So that's one of the things that I've really grieved, is that loss of like intention, mm-hmm. right? What I expected life to be like with children. And then as they get older, you know, you sort of get more freedom. And my plan was always, as a writer, to work from home, right? So I was working, doing interviewing people and writing up, you know, writing articles and stuff. And then I had to stop because I just couldn't go anywhere. I couldn't interview people. I kept breaking bones in my ribs, and we didn't know why. And then we found out why.
I think that one of the things that people often ask me about is how, in those early days after you get news like this, because for you, like our family, your cancer diagnosis wasn't met with much optimism or much hope, right? It's like, this is what you have. We don't know how long you're going to live, but you're going to die from this.
Yeah.
And the notion that you can keep going after that is hard for people who have never dealt with something like this to understand. My response is always like, what is the choice? I had little kids, you had little kids, but I wonder, we still do, but I wonder if you could kind of take me through what you remember. You know, you already mentioned not being able to pick Una up, but what you remember about those first like months after your diagnosis and how you guys sort of settled. I always say like, I've settled into my sadness, like sort of how you sort of settled into life with this as your reality.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I was listening to your first podcast and when you heard about Chris's diagnosis, and it was sort of the same thing with me. Like, thankfully my mom and my husband were there, and my mother-in-law was there because she is a nurse. And what I remember is just having my head in the bucket, in the garbage bucket, waiting to barf up all of my feelings. Mm-hmm. It was true. There's like, you have this type of cancer and there is no cure and you're going to die from it. That's basically what they said. And my oncologist told me later, like, she didn't expect me to last 6 months. Mm-hmm. So
based on how far the disease had progressed at that
had point. Progressed. And I mean, they say that like getting it in the, so far it's only in the bones, and that's sort of the best case scenario. Actually, it's also in my uterus now. So it has spread, but it hasn't spread to my lungs or my liver or my brain, mm-hmm. which are sort of the scarier, but to me, the scarier areas. Mm-hmm. And I did have a couple good stable years where I was like still running, mm-hmm. like my bones had healed. I was on tamoxifen, which is pretty basic. Like, after I did the first round of chemo, I was on tamoxifen, and it lasted for about 2 years until it stopped working and I started to degrade again. Mm. So it's easy. Like, I never forget that it's there. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm always kind of exhausted, but it was nice having some pain-free time for a while and being able to focus on my family, mm-hmm. and just do the things that I wanted to do. Like, you know, make dinner and play with my kids and mm-hmm. go hiking and go traveling. Like, the year after when I finished chemo the first time, the kids were still young. And I said, let's just leave. Like, we went on a 6-week road trip out to BC, and just mm-hmm. who cares? The kids can come out of school. Yeah, like, one was little, in right? kindergarten, I think. Like, mm-hmm. they probably learned more on the beach than they learned in school that year. Mm-hmm. And we did that twice.
Yeah. I mean, I think that that's also something that we experienced. And in a lot of ways, I found it, I don't know, grounding, knowing what was important to you. I think when some people go through these things, they have these like grand things that they want to do, the things they want to see. And not that I wouldn't love to do those things, but really what became important to us was so elemental, right? Like, just mm-hmm. bike rides, and movie nights and, you know, maybe visiting family or whatever, but we didn't feel this pressure to do these big things, except for Chris took Cohen to like game 7 of the World Series and told him at like 4 in the morning. That was a pretty cool thing. You know, he understands it's cool, but he doesn't understand why when we're telling him, waking him up at 4 in the morning, like why we're crying and why we feel like it's this big thing, because every memory you make, you have to think in your head, is this the last time we're going to be able to make a memory like this, right?
Yeah.
And everything is so much heavier as a result of that. And that pressure, I think, can also be crushing. That sort of pressure to make everything like a Hallmark moment, right?
Yeah.
I wonder how you've dealt with that with your girls.
Yeah, like Christmas is hard because I'm always like, is this the last one? Mm-hmm. Yeah, I cry a lot these days.
Yeah.
But just like, what I had.
This has been such a hard year for you. Like, this has probably been the hardest year for you illness-wise, right? And then the pandemic on top of that.
Yeah. Like right now, actually took the phone out of here because the hospital will probably call. I had an MRI yesterday. I have like 4 fractures in my spine right now. And it affects like the whole, all the way around, you know? So I spend a lot of time lying down. It's boring as hell. But pain is also distracting. Like you think I could spend all my time lying down reading, but you can't, you know? So, but to get back to what you said, yeah, like I try and make things like Christmas and holidays not over the top, you know? Like I don't want there to be a big shift when I'm not here. But I'm the only one who does Christmas in this house. Like it's all on me. So it'll be up to the girls to like keep it going when I'm gone. But at least they all kind of know who's doing the stockings.
But I know they're old enough. They kind of start to get it. Yeah,
exactly.
So we've obviously talked about the fact that you're a writer. And so I wonder if it just felt very natural for you to start writing about cancer and being sick.
It did.
Yeah.
I find like I'm not great at talking through feelings. And so I can write them out. It's sort of, even though I write fast, it sort of slows my brain down, right? And then you reread it and edit it. And I find that's the easiest way to process. And in the beginning, when I started writing about it, like I was writing about it on, you know, Instagram, and people would really reach out and be like, oh, I'm glad you're writing about this. Cause not everybody with cancer wants to talk about it. You know, like I have another good friend. She just doesn't want to talk about it.
Sure,
like some other mom came up to her and she was like, we cancer moms have to stick together. This was when her child was little. And she's just like,
yeah,
you know, she does her own thing and that's fine, but she appreciates me writing about it.
Totally.
And that's how we became friends.
I think that's something that I've experienced too. And I always find it like a lot of people say to me, oh, it's just so like, it's so brave what you're doing. And I don't really ever, like, that is not how I feel about it. It feels to me like this is how I'm surviving.
Yeah.
Like I'm writing about it. I'm talking about it. And when I do that, I can let go of some of it, or not let go of it, because it's always with you. But when I put like the most emotional things that I write, when I'm done writing them, those are my best days.
Yeah.
I feel the lightest. And, you know, it's absolutely cathartic for me. And, you know, I assume that that's kind of what it offers you too.
It is, exactly. And I don't, you know, people use that term a lot. Oh, you're so brave and strong. And it's just really normal. It's just how I have to process things and get them out of my head and onto paper sometimes, because otherwise you're just sort of choked up in this daily grief.
Totally. And I feel like my anxiety, when I know that I haven't written in a while and I have something, but I'm not sure quite yet, like what the something is that I need to write about. Those are the days where I have a hard time settling. And then it's almost like this purge. And then I feel like I can take a breath again.
Yeah. That's one of the reasons I started my sort of the Substack newsletter mm-hmm. thing, because I sort of told myself like I would write on Mondays and talk about cancer. And then other days I could write something else. And then I've got a story that I've been publishing on it. One that I actually wrote when I had started it before I got diagnosed. It was something that took my mind away from what I was dealing with. Yep. And I remember one night I was sitting at this desk, which is, you can't see, it's a total mess, and writing. And then my oldest daughter came in and threw up all over my feet, literally. Like I turned and she was like, "Mommy." And there was pus everywhere. And I just thought, and we were dealing with lice at the time. Like, I don't know why my girls kept getting lice like 4 years in a row from the school. Life doesn't quit just because you have cancer. Totally. And being a mom doesn't quit just because there's like awful things going on in your life. And it was just, I remember writing about that, like just pus everywhere. And you just get up and clean it, even though you're sore and bald and
nauseous yourself.
Yeah, it was not nice, actually. Mm. Poor kid.
No, and I think there is an element that I've thought of about you. And how much extra difficult this is for a mom. Not to say it's not very difficult for dads too, because it certainly is. And I know you have a very supportive and involved partner. But like you said, like you're the one who does the Christmas.
Yeah.
You're the mom. And as much as we would like everybody to be like, yeah, the mental load, the men are like, you're the mom. And you have three girls. Mm-hmm. And I think that for most people, when they think about you, that's where their heart really stops, is the notion of your girls. And everybody has their different grief in this, but certainly for me, the hardest part has been the idea that my kids would lose their dad. Mm-hmm. And that's the hardest part for him. Like whatever happens to him, he can manage, right? Like physically. But the notion that they would be left without him and the pain that that would cause them. And I wonder if you could just talk to me about how you process that and how you deal with that on a daily basis.
Yeah, it's tough because my girls and I are really, really close.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I stayed home with them. I didn't work. And just really wanted to create that bond. Mm-hmm. And I'm really glad it did.
Yeah.
But you know, I keep telling myself. So I've had 5 years post-diagnosis, 5.5 now. And I keep telling myself I'm going to have another 5. Like that's the way I get through it.
Yeah.
Like no matter how sick I get, I've never once thought that I was actually dying. Like I've never been that close. Husband, on the other hand, thought I was dying, and that has created some problems because he just has to separate himself completely. So now it's just me and the girls. Mm. He's still here,
sure,
but also kind of not.
Mm-hmm. Not long after Chris was diagnosed, a friend of mine asked if we still fight, and I was like, "Yeah, we're still married." Like, and I think there is this misconception that an illness can just take all of that away and you can just focus on how much you love each other and all the happy moments and just being there for each other. And I think like maybe that's the case in like a really aggressive and quick illness and death. Like maybe that's the case. But when you have an illness, like you have, like Chris has, that's long. It's drawn out. Hmm. Marriage is not made easier by that.
No.
And I wonder what you feel comfortable sharing about that part of this for you, like what this has done to your marriage.
It has done a lot. And it's actually really hard for me to talk about without crying because it's like always on the surface, like in the beginning. We were so scared to lose each other, you know? Mm-hmm. Then And I found this with lots of people, like, you know, everyone was so shocked that I was sick because I just seemed so healthy until I wasn't. And so in the beginning, it was like, my husband was like, all you have to do is stay alive. That's your job. All you have to do is stay alive for as long as possible.
Yeah.
But now it's different. Now it's like, most days I feel like he's like, are you still here? Like, are we still having to deal with this? Mm. So it has changed from being an active participant to being kind of annoyed with me all the time. Mm. Like, that's how this last year has been. And he said, like, he doesn't like being home having to see me sick all day. Like, because before he'd go to work, right? Mm-hmm. And he's been working from home since March. And we've been very isolated because of my illness. I've mm-hmm. got both vaccinations now, thankfully. You know, I've barely seen my friends. And it's been the roughest year on my marriage possible. Like, I just feel like I'm not even liked anymore. Oh. And that's been the hardest thing to deal with, because now I have to grieve that as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think it's such a disservice to have these conversations about these things and not, it's almost like that toxic positivity thing to say, like, yeah. Oh, we can just, like, it's just about love. It's just about love. And certainly we say that and we feel that way. And other times, like, the same thing you've done the last 15 years that I've known you still drives me crazy, even though now you have, you know, doesn't matter that it's like, but it's such a complicated thing. And the resources for people right now have been just nothing. And yeah. So whereas in the past, you guys might have sought therapy, some counseling for this period of time, or he just would have been able to have that break from everyday life at home by going to work. You don't get that. And it's not a small thing what this has done to all families, but especially families who are dealing with this like acute trauma all the time.
Yeah.
It's not a small thing.
This is why I didn't bother with mascara.
Right. So, like, I know that, you know, we talked a little bit about writing and what that does for us. And I know for me personally, you know, I think I heard somebody one time say something about, like, you know, our kids never really know us. And I thought about that in relation to going through this. And I thought, you know, I want my kids to be able to look back on the things that we did and the choices that we made and understand them maybe in a way that I won't be able to tell them down the line. And that was another reason why I wanted to write and kind of document all of this. And in a way, it's like, it's documenting it. It's giving them something to reach back to. It's hopefully, you know, whatever they frustrated about with me when they're an adult, because there's going to be things. Hopefully they can look back on this and see that part of humanity that we sometimes can't see in our parents. Mm-hmm. You know, that was one of the reasons I wanted to do it. And the other reason, I think, is because I did want to leave whatever I could do to sort of help facilitate this idea of a legacy. When you have young kids and one of the parents has a terminal illness, of course, you have to think about what that parent is going to leave behind, that mm-hmm. notion of a legacy. I know that, you know, this is something that you've thought about a lot, you know, and you wrote about it even in a magazine article in late 2019. And in it, you wrote, "When I was first diagnosed with stage 4 breast cancer, one of my biggest fears, aside from the obvious one of dying, was that there were so many books I would miss out on reading with my 3 young girls. This was in 2016. Fast forward to 2019, and my respite instability has come to an end. The cancer has spread to my hips, legs, and possibly other places. At this point, it is hard to keep up. I break ribs when I sneeze, I walk with a cane, and need a wheelchair for any distance further than up the stairs to my bed. There is talk of hip replacement surgery. I am 43 years old. My daughters are 11, 9, and 6. It is terrifying." So of course you've had that surgery now and your girls are all a couple years older. Mm-hmm. But I wonder how you came to know that books and reading were the legacy you wanted to leave behind.
I don't know. I mean, I started collecting children's books in high school mm-hmm. and I just really loved children's books, even though I haven't managed to write a decent one yet. And I didn't want to do crafts all day and I didn't want to play all day, but they knew I would, they'd bring me a book. They knew mommy would stop. Mm-hmm. And that's just sort of what we did, is we would read and we had lots of books. And, you know, I bought journals and I wrote them, started writing journals to them, and I just stopped. And that just didn't feel like the thing to do, especially there's three of them, like having to keep up journaling for three of them.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, some people write letters, mm-hmm. and I have this thing also about stuff. Like when you're gone, if you leave behind all this stuff, it could be infused with meaning that's not actually there.
Mm.
If that makes sense, you know, oh, this was mommy's favorite pen. Then the pen gets lost, or the pen gets dried out, or this was mommy's thing. And now we've lost it.
Yeah.
I mean, I have thought, in addition to the books, and I have given them, like, for their Christmas and birthday presents, I try and buy them like a really nice book that, and then I inscribe inside of it, you know, like things that we've enjoyed, like a really beautiful copy of The Secret Garden. I have thought of starting like little boxes for them. You know, I have like jewelry from my grandmother. It's costume jewelry, but it's nice, you know, it's fun. I kind of want to knit each one of them a really nice shawl, like a wedding shawl or something for the future. It doesn't have to be for a wedding, but just that's what they're called sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
Because you know, I don't expect to be here for weddings and grandchildren. And that's a fact. So, like, I just want them to have good memories.
Yeah. I was thinking about that because, you know, Chris is in this clinical trial and we have, we have a lot of hope in it. And if it isn't the thing that's going to turn his ALS from terminal to chronic, then I at least hope that it's going to keep him here until the next thing comes along, right?
Yeah.
But this...
That's exactly how I look at it, too.
At all your treatments, right? Because so much has changed, right, in breast cancer, in metastatic breast cancer, right?
Like, I'm definitely in the chronic illness portion of it. Mm-hmm. And the longer I can stay on a treatment... Hopefully the more treatments will be lined up afterwards. That's sort of how we in the metastatic community look at it, right?
Right. It's like, how much time can I buy?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And so, you know, this whole podcast is about sadness and loss and also about hope. And I wondered what hope looks like for you, because, you know, that's a challenge when you are given an illness that some people tell you you aren't going to survive, right?
Hmm.
Where do you look for your hope and where do you find it? Because I am convinced that without hope of some kind, whatever that looks like for you, life is not tenable.
Yeah.
You know, and so what does that look like for you? What does hope look like for you?
You know, my hope is that we figure out what's going on with my spine compression and the fractures in my spine, and then that will work for a while. And so that's where I find hope, is just waiting for the next treatment, hoping that it works, assuming that I'm going to be around for another 5 years, maybe get to see my oldest graduate from high school. Who knows? You know, I always like to be creating something. Like, I'm always knitting something, whether it turns out or not.
Mm-hmm.
And cooking, I like give myself challenges. For me, I think it's just keep creating and putting things out there into the world, because that's such a part of me.
In February, I know you got some good news that your health was pretty stable. I know you've been struggling with a lot of pain in your back and your ribs since then. But at that time you wrote, all this nausea and tiredness from the current chemo regime is paying off. Some days it feels like a high price to pay for stability when what we are going for is quality of life. But quantity is something to strive for as well when you are young and have young children. And I thought that was a really, that's a really important thing, because your illness is happening to you, but it's happening to them too. And so the decisions that you're making aren't always for you. And I just wonder if you could talk about that, the way that that quantity versus quality impacts you and how often you have to put out what the other people in your family might want for you ahead of what you want.
Well, I mean, it's true because, I mean, I actually just started chemo again today. I'm on a 2-week on, 2-week off cycle of oral chemo, which is nice. I don't have to go into the hospital to get it. But by the end of the 2 weeks, I'm exhausted. You know, I spend more time laying down, just resting. I usually need a nap in the afternoon, whereas I can get power through on the week, 2 weeks off, often without having a nap in the afternoon. But it is, the quality still seems to be there. You know, I can still make it to dinner. I can still make dinner often. Mm-hmm. And if I can't, we've taught everybody to cook.
So quality looks like for you, it changes what the quality is kind of what you're saying. Yes. Like what you would have thought before you were diagnosed, when you were running with the stroller, double stroller and all of that, your quality of life and what you needed your quality of life to be then versus what you consider quality life now has obviously changed a considerable amount.
I mean, I can still write mm-hmm. and I can still be here mm-hmm. and I can still do things with my family.
Yep.
And that has to be enough. And I know there'll come a point where I have to make a decision. You know, I'm terrified of it going to my brain. Everyone I've known who's had it in their brain, they get patch jobs and radiation and it's a short-term solution. And then they're usually gone. Mm-hmm. And so I know someday there'll be hard decisions to make because mm-hmm. I don't want to just exist. Mm-hmm. And I don't want them to watch me mm-hmm. have to like deteriorate like that. But for now, it still seems far away. You know, my brain is still working. I think my brain is still working just fine. I think not so everybody too. Agrees, but yeah. I think it is.
Have you read the book Being Mortal by
Monday?
It's beautiful. But really the whole notion is what makes life worth living. And then everybody has to decide that for themselves. At what point is it not a quality of life that is enough for you, right? And this is something that with Chris's illness, everybody has to decide. Mm-hmm. You know, some people are okay with like saying, well, I might be completely paralyzed. I might be able to only move my eyes, but that's enough for me as long as I can see my kids and my family and have them around me and I have my brain, you know?
Right.
But that's a different question for everybody. What makes life worth living for you?
Yeah, there's so many things I want to do still. You know, so many things I want to write still. So many people I still like talking to. You know, like I have this one friend from high school who lives in Vancouver and she comes to visit sometimes. And the big dream is for me to like go on my own. Mm-hmm. For like a long weekend to visit her.
What a thing, hey?
Yeah. I mean, we used to want to go to, she has a place in Scotland actually. And because her mom is from Scotland mm-hmm. and her mom has moved back there. And so the dream used to be that I could go there. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you have to sort of rewrite your dreams mm-hmm. when, you know, you probably shouldn't be that far away from the health services of your country.
Yeah. Okay.
Like, that's true. At this point, I would just love to go visit my parents.
Yeah.
And my sister out in Ontario, because that's where they all live now. And, you know, even that would be mm-hmm. a dream. That would be enough. You know, I love to cook. I love to try new recipes. I love to write. I like to hang out with my kids. I like to play Pokemon.
That's right. You guys like Pokemon.
We do. My husband and I, we like just go out on our own.
It's Pokemon date.
Kind of like a date. Yeah.
I love it.
Sometimes we get a vegan milkshake somewhere and don't have to share it with the kids.
Nice.
And I don't feel like I'm done yet. Mm-hmm. And I don't feel like I'm dying. Mm-hmm. Like I have crappy days where I'm like, this pain level could really be adjusted to be less, mm-hmm. yeah. which we're working on. But I feel like I'm not in the point where I have to make those decisions.
Yeah.
About quality first, because the quality is still really high.
Exactly. And those things, I think I'm more of a forward thinker. Like, I'm like, well, what are we going to do if this happens? What are we going to do if this happens? And what are we going to do if this happens? And Chris is like, what is the point of this?
Right.
If that happens, then we will deal with it. But living in that space is not, it's not a productive place to be.
Right.
So I'm sure this is similar for you guys. In our house, we talk about death and grief more than I ever anticipated, and certainly more than I ever did growing up, because we didn't talk about it at all.
Yeah.
We didn't have to. We were very lucky, right?
Mm-hmm.
We talk about it a lot. You know, those conversations with the kids always leave me feeling pretty hollowed out. They're always hard. And I just wonder, like, what are the conversations about grief and death like in your family?
It really depends per child.
Yeah.
Some just talk as though I'm going to be here forever.
Mm.
And that's sort of how they cope.
Mm.
They know I'm not going to be, but so far I've proved that I can stick around.
Yeah.
Because it's been 5.5 years and I've been able to do a lot of things. My middle child, who's very, very astute, I think she gets it more than the others.
Mm-hmm.
That she's got that sort of scientific brain, and she says things to me like, you're not going to be here when I have children, are you? We're not going to get to keep you forever. Like, she just knows. She
doesn't miss anything.
Doesn't miss a thing, that one. She's my planner and my thinker, and I just feel sorry for her that she gets it so much. And, you know, because she's so busy, you can just assume that it's not bothering her. And then she comes out with these questions, you know.
You know, there are times when I'm not myself, I'm having a hard day or whatever. Yes. And my oldest is very tuned in to how I'm doing, mm-hmm. as well. And
I bet.
Yeah. And it will just be, Mom, you okay? Everything okay? Yeah. Just like little whispers across the, you know, hug, you want a hug? We haven't had very many hugs today. And I think about, like, they'll never understand. Maybe we're leaving this for them to listen to. So maybe they will.
Maybe they will.
Maybe understand how, what they give us.
Yeah.
You know, because when people say, well, how do you go on when you're told that? When you get that diagnosis, how do you keep putting one foot in front of the other? Well, it's because this kid has to go to baseball and this kid puked on my feet and the laundry is coming out of the laundry room. It doesn't stop. And kids in that way, like in many ways, are this huge blessing, but in the way that they propel you forward, there's not a way to quantify how powerful that is.
Mm-hmm. I kind of think, How do you not? Like, this is just seems like such a normal reaction to just keep pushing through and keep trying to be yourself and not lose yourself to this illness or to somebody else's illness,
mm-hmm.
because you're taking care of them. And the only way through is forward.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah,
I just have to keep on keeping on with my girls and my life. And, you know, nobody's life really is going to turn out the way they think it's going to turn out anyway.
It reminds me of something that Paul Kalanithi wrote in his book, When Breath Becomes Air.
Which I haven't had the courage to read yet, but I do have it.
It will break you.
It will. And I will read it because I am going through those books.
Yeah, it is beautiful. But this part I think about a lot. In talking about how the thing with our kids and the thing with us is that what we know is that we just have a more close up view of how fragile life is than most people do. And especially for them at that age. And what he wrote was, I began to realize that coming in such close contact with my own mortality had changed both nothing and everything. Before my cancer was diagnosed, I knew that someday I would die, but I didn't know when. after the diagnosis. I knew someday I would die, but I didn't know when. But now I knew it acutely. The problem wasn't really a scientific one. The fact of death is unsettling, yet there is no other way to live. And, you know, I think the thing that I come back to, too, is like, what I hate about this illness is that it's this part of their story, and that this having a dad who, you know, whose voice is different, who can't smile, who eats through a feeding tube, having a mom whose bones are always broken and who's in pain and nauseous all the time. Like, I want to take these things from my kids. And at the same time, I know these things are going to make them better.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know. And, you know, it's funny because, like, in children's books, the moms always die, right?
Totally.
And I tell the girls, like, well, that's just going to make you into superheroes and things when you're older. Because yeah. Moira, my oldest, is like, only people who've had hard lives do really exceptional things. And I was like, oh, well, there, you're fine then.
Yeah, you're, look at you.
Yeah, but I mean,
your college
true,
essays like, are already written.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it's true, because what is a good story without hardship? What is a good story without loss? That's what makes life compelling.
It's true. I mean, even some of the stories I'm writing, like sometimes the dad leaves, you know, like somebody has to leave, or mm-hmm. there has to be some sort of conflict in mm-hmm. order to move forward mm-hmm. and find yourself. It just sucks when you're, you know, 9 and 10 and having to do it.
Totally. It's completely unfair. And I sometimes, when I'm getting ready for a conversation, will ask a few of my friends, and I'll ask Chris, like, well, what would you want to hear in this conversation? Just so I make sure that I've kind of covered all my bases and I'm not off in some other, like, very selfish land of what I want to know and not what everybody else wants to know. And one of my friends wrote to me and said, how do you keep from being angry all the time? And I thought about that in relation to kids, especially.
Yeah. That's a good question. I think part of it is I'm just naturally a happy person. Like, I went through a really bad depression in my 20s that I had to work through, like mm-hmm. with hospital assistance depression. Mm-hmm. But came out the other side of it. I just think I'm naturally a positive person.
Yeah.
And it's not that I don't get angry and I don't get like, why is me? But then I think about everybody else I know and I think, well, why not me? Right. You know, there's no history of cancer in my family. My sister's like, you always got to be the special one.
Yeah.
That's what my brother and sister said. Because when they heard me, like, you know, I'm the active one and I'm the fit one and I'm the one who does yoga and, you know, has been a vegetarian since junior high.
Yeah.
And I'm the one who got sick.
Mm-hmm.
And it just is what it is. So yeah. you just have to keep going.
You have to do the best with what you're given. Because what's the exactly. choice?
That's it. Like, if the choice is giving up, I choose not to give up.
Exactly. So I think one of the things that really stands out to me in your writing about your life is how much you really enjoy simple things. You love to knit. You love to bake cakes. You love good books. And I think that, you know, simple joys are such an important thing in life. In January, you wrote, "For some reason, this seems to be my favorite time of year to take photos, or at least I tell myself that when I'm taking photos of the winter sun. But then I love taking photos in the spring of things beginning to grow and of the bees in the summer and the changing colors in the fall. And I don't really have a favorite time of year except whatever season it happens to be at the exact moment I am in. I don't think that is a bad way to live at all." I think that's basically the goal in life, is to take what's in front of you and to find the beauty in it and mm-hmm. to be present. I think it's a very profound way to live. And I wonder if that's always been your inclination.
I think it has. Like, I just kind of always embrace the season that I'm in. But what I wrote is true. Like, I really do love taking pictures of the winter sun.
Mm-hmm.
And so if I'm healthy enough to get out there and walk, like I love to go down to Confederation Park and just take pictures of the sun through the trees. And, but then spring comes and I'm happy it's spring. And then summer comes and I'm happy it's summer. And I just think like people just love to talk about the weather, right? And get annoyed at the weather. And it just seems so inconsequential to me. You know, it's just, it could snow tomorrow.
No, totally.
And it wouldn't even be surprising. And you just sort of have to embrace it.
Mm-hmm.
You can complain about it, but it's not, the weather doesn't care.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. And it's sort of the exactly. same thing. Like I could complain about my cancer all the time, but the cancer doesn't care.
Mm-hmm.
Or I can just live with it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's in me and it's a part of me.
Yeah.
And while I am fighting it, I'm also living with it.
Well, I'm going to put all my hope in your hope, which is that you got another 5 years at least, and all these things are going to come in that time. And you're going to be here to continue to read books with your girls, bake more cakes, and knit many beautiful shawls. I think that if we're talking about legacies, you said something just when you were talking, and I think it's a beautiful legacy, whether you live until you're 90 or whatever. You said, embrace the season you're in. And it's beautiful. I really love talking to you today, Melanie.
I'm talking to you too, Kelsey.
A huge thanks to Melanie for her story, her time, and her honesty. I look forward to seeing her at the playground again soon, and hopefully when I do, I can give her a big hug. If you'd like to follow Melanie's story, you can find her online at themelimello.substack.com. That's the themelimello.substack.com. I've also put a link to her website in the description of this episode. The border between the kingdom of the sick and the kingdom of the well is tenuous. And when people enter the former at a young age, it seems especially unjust. But the truth is, everyone will enter it eventually. And there is something tragically beautiful about having the time to shape what you'll leave behind for the people you love. As Melanie wrote, you think when you have children, you have all this time with them, but it isn't necessarily true. My fear is that all they are going to remember about me is how my illness colored their childhood with the looming threat of death. They are terrified when I sneeze that I am going to break a bone, and they have all but resigned themselves to the fact that I'm not much fun. Some days, all I can do is get out of bed and feed them lunch, while other mothers are out attending Terry Fox runs and volunteering at the school. But books are something I know, and reading is something we can do together. Even on my worst days, we can snuggle up and read something. As Sirius Black says in Harry Potter and the Prisoner of Azkaban, the ones who love us never really leave us. You can always find them in here. Sirius points to his heart when he is saying this, but I believe that the ones who love us can also be found in the pages of a book long after they are gone. At least that is what I hope for my girls. Here's to 5 more years and beyond, Melanie. All my love to you. Thanks, as always, for listening.